Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Utah Governor Spencer Cox and other state leaders believe Utah can become a hub for this new generation of nuclear energy. At the center of their plan are these small modular reactors. They're compact nuclear plants, basically, designed to produce power more safely, more efficiently, and with less space than the massive reactors of the past. So forget the huge cooling towers and the sprawling complexes. These next-gen reactors are said to be about the size of a shipping container or a school bus. And the idea is to deliver power to a grid that's under growing stress. Now, there are a lot of outstanding questions here about cost and waste and safety. And then, of course, there's Utah's history with the atomic age. Thousands of people who lived with and died from cancers they believed were caused by the government's atmospheric bomb tests in the Nevada desert. And there's another angle to that history that we should mention. Utah has been a player in the development of nuclear energy before. The historian Sarah Fox told us about it this week. She said, during the Manhattan Project, most of the uranium used in the American bomb program came from overseas. And she says officials wanted their own supply, uranium from here.
So in the wake of World War II, you have the formation of the Atomic Energy Commission in 1946, which is designed essentially to kind of create civilian oversight over nuclear weapons technology. And a big priority for the Atomic Energy Commission is establishing a domestic supply of uranium. And so the Atomic Energy Commission basically announces the first federally sponsored mineral rush. They set a guaranteed finding bonus for verified uranium claims, which was a huge amount of money. It was $10,000. And there was some historical knowledge of uranium being extracted on the Navajo Nation. And so there were stories on the Navajo Nation of bags of uranium that were just kind of piled up sitting around because there wasn't much demand. And so the mineral rush in a lot of ways kind of starts in Navajo country. But there is uranium elsewhere around the West. There's uranium in Utah in many places, outside of Moab, for example. And the way a lot of that uranium is being identified is by kind of weekend prospectors. During the early 1950s, you could order a Geiger counter from the Sears and Roebuck catalog for like $10. And so this became a thing that families in Utah were doing together on the weekends, going out with the kids to prospect for uranium, like taking a picnic and going out into the desert, you know, in the mountains around Moab, for example. But a lot of folks were just prospecting on their property. And part of what is driving the kind of mass adoption, especially in Utah and elsewhere in the Intermountain West, of, you know, popular prospecting, is that people are often going out with Geiger counters and having them go off. But what they were actually finding was the lingering fallout from a recent atmospheric nuclear test upwind in southern Nevada. And this was happening so frequently that the AEC issued a booklet. It was primarily distributed among school children in southern Utah, kind of explaining the mechanics of nuclear testing to people. And one of the sections in this little booklet talked about how a lot of people were going out to prospect for uranium, and there was a little cartoon of a cowboy with a Geiger counter. And there's an explanation from the AEC that a lot of people are reporting false uranium claims when what they're actually picking up with their Geiger counters is radiation from quote-unquote controlled nuclear tests in Nevada. If a family, you know, did find a uranium claim, what they would do is they would go and file a claim at the local Atomic Energy Commission office. And the Atomic Energy Commission would then send someone to verify that claim. And then if there was, in fact, uranium there, a mine would be developed on that site. And uranium would be extracted from that site as long as it was feasible. And then a lot of the waste produced in mining at that site would remain there. So it seemed to a lot of folks like this amazing way to share in the growing prosperity of the 1950s, of the post-World War II years, you know, a big check from the federal government and mine royalties, you know, indefinitely into the future. But it also meant long-term chronic exposure to the contaminants that are connected to the uranium mining industry. We're in this moment right now where nuclear power and the potential benefits, the purported benefits of small modular reactors and modern nuclear power plant technology is really being framed as this amazing clean alternative to fossil fuels. And interestingly enough, this is a really similar environment to the 1950s when the uranium boom is taking place in the American West. And there's all of this excitement about modernity and what this new nuclear technology will provide in terms of national security and increasingly in terms of power and energy. And so there's this sort of mythical story about how we've arrived in this new modern era and we have this amazing technology that's going to solve all these problems. But the same concerns around health and environmental problems are present now that were present 50 years ago. And the idea that this is just going to miraculously generate income out of thin air, it's just as much of a folktale or a fantasy now as it was in the 1950s and 60s.
That's the historian Sarah Fox. She'll be back a little bit later in the program. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about Utah's bet on nuclear power today. The governor is pushing to get a demonstration nuclear reactor built and running in Emery County by next year. So we're talking about how these reactors work, about the questions of cost and waste, and how all of this lands in a state where nuclear power has a deeply complicated history. But let's start with some basics. We talked with the Deseret News reporter Amy Joy O'Donohue this week about the governor's vision for energy in the future. It's a project called Operation Gigawatt.
I think with the launch of Operation Gigawatt, Governor Cox could see plainly that with the tremendous amount of interest AI and data centers have in this state, and the fact that we're the fastest growing state and economy in the country, we need to be ready to meet that head on. And these data centers are not just knocking on the doors of Utah, they're knocking on the doors of other states. And why not open the door in Utah? Utah just wants to be prepared. The development of these reactors is something that doesn't happen overnight. And they want to start putting their toes in the water right now so they're ready when the technology is cost-effective and when we need it. And it seems to me that there's a real drive to secure safe, carbon-free, baseload energy for the state, if the price is right.
Before we talk any further about the nuclear technology, just give us a sense of these small modular reactor units. One of the things you mentioned to us is they're not your grandparents' nuclear power plants. So would you just give us a sense of what we're talking about? Give people a sense of what these are exactly. The governor wants one up and running in a year's time in Emery County. So what are they?
Well, they're small. Again, they're not these gargantuan nuclear power plants of the past. It's called modular for a reason. So if you can think about like a trailer park, something that you're putting together, you bring in one self-contained unit, it's fabricated offsite. They truck it in. So if you want two to meet your energy needs, you can have two. Or if you need four, or if you need six, and they can steadily add on to that to make the facility itself meet the energy needs that are required.
But one of the questions is whether these small, you know, modular reactors are actually cost efficient. And that gets us to the story about this so-called carbon-free power project. Now, let me see if I can get the details right. This was this effort that involved these small utilities here in Utah, among other states. And the idea was to build these small modular nuclear reactors in Idaho using this technology developed by this company called NuScale Power. And it was going to be one of the first SMR projects, small modular reactor projects in the U.S. And as I understand it, it was seen as this kind of test case for whether this new nuclear technology was going to scale economically. Have I got that right so far?
Yes, you do.
Okay. So then they get to work on this project, but it doesn't work out very well. And in 2023, just a few years ago, the project was canceled. And one of the main reasons – there were some other kinds of reasons, but one of the main reasons was the costs just kept rising. I mean, the estimated cost originally for the project was $5 billion. The number climbed to like $9 billion. A lot of these municipalities said, this is not penciling out. We're not interested. So I guess one of the big questions is – what makes Utah leaders think anything is going to change? Like, if it wouldn't scale in 2023, why would it scale 2 years later?
Well, and that's a good question. I believe that the technology is advancing so rapidly. These companies who are behind these projects are working furiously to make them more cost-effective and more plausible for cities that want a project like this that delivers carbon-free emissions. And
so are you saying that Utah leaders and the governor are just banking on the fact that the technology eventually will pencil out? It will become – I mean, one of the things you've done in your reporting, it's interesting. You spoke with this MIT professor, Scott Kemp, I think it was, who said this small modular reactor idea isn't new. They tried these in the 50s and 60s, but they didn't pencil out then. They just got to be way too expensive. It seems like what you're saying is the governor and others are thinking, well, this will eventually pencil out. Is that what you're saying?
I believe they have the optimism that it will pencil out again as the technology evolves and develops and these companies – you know, become more proficient in the application of science, there will come a time when it becomes cost effective.
But it's not right now. Is there an acknowledgement of that right now among all the parties involved?
I have not heard an acknowledgement from top political leaders that this could be expensive or that it could drive energy costs up for consumers. I mean, an SMR is not going to pop up overnight, but I do believe they want to get started now so they're ready when those costs come down. The technology is out there to be had. It just needs to be refined.
Governor Cox says Utah has the workforce, it has the resources to make all of this happen. But he also says that Utah has the political will to make this happen. Is that true? There's a story that plays out at Eagle Mountain that raises the question of whether the public is really on board with all of this. In January, the Eagle Mountain Planning Commission voted to deny this ordinance that would have opened the door to, you know, a number of energy options, including these small modular reactors. And the public was concerned. There was pushback about safety, about regulations. And they, as I said, the Planning Commission denied the ordinance. Now, the proposal is just on hold. It may come back. But what does this tell you about whether there is political will or public will for these kinds of things?
I think it depends on who you're talking to and the type of salesmanship that's involved. I wasn't at those meetings with Eagle Mountain. I do know it's on hold. It was bounced over to the city council, and I believe they're just sitting on it for now. People don't understand nuclear. They hear nuclear, and they think of Fukushima. They think of Chernobyl, Three Mile Island. And I'm agnostic when it comes to nuclear. Let me make that clear. But when you look at the, you know, statistics involving accidents related to energy projects, nuclear is at the bottom of the list. They have a tremendous safety record, but I think there's a fear of the unknown. But we did go out in the field and do a poll last year, and our poll showed that 65% of the people surveyed were in favor of a nuclear plant in the state, while 31% were opposed. And political leaders acknowledge that there needs to be a rigorous public information campaign and outreach to help people understand, again, that these aren't your grandfather's nuclear power plants that tower over the city. They look intimidating and nasty. These are small, self-contained, don't use as much water, have passive cooling systems, and can be shut off remotely at a drop of a hat. So again, I think there's some education to be had there. Anytime you talk about splitting an atom, people, they can't put their head around that. And I would point out that Utah already has a nuclear reactor, and people drive by it every day. You know, it's housed at the University of Utah for test purposes.
Well, let me ask you about, this is a more abstract question, I suppose, but what are we to make of the problematic, conflicted history that Utah and Utahns have had with the testing and the creation of nuclear power? Are lawmakers or the governor talking about that part, or is it just seen as something in the past and something that doesn't need to get in the way of us moving forward with technology that is quite new?
Well, and if you're talking about the downwinders and the above ground nuclear tests, that conversation does not come up. I mean, that was, you know, decades and decades ago when people didn't have the sophistication or the knowledge that we have today. There's new regulations in place. There are new safeguards in place. And again, I believe that it's incumbent upon Utah leaders to educate the public and let them know what these technologies are capable of doing. You know, there was a report that came out yesterday from the U.S. Department of Energy that said basically, you know, if we don't do something different with all the baseload energy that's slated for retirement, i.e. coal-fired power plants, we're going to be in a world of hurt when it comes to power outages. The grid is not sustainable as it is, and it's getting worse. I mean, I had somebody from the utility company told me if everybody in a 3-square-mile area were to buy an electric car and plug in, it would strain the grid. So if we can't handle electric vehicles, I mean, how are we going to handle AI and data centers coming to this state?
Well, it sounds like, Amy Joy, this is going forward. The nuclear part is going forward. Is there anything you can see that would stop it at this point?
Well, you know, I do believe that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission needs to streamline the permitting. And by streamline, I don't mean rubber stamp, but not make it so laborious. But there needs to be a reckoning amongst the public. And I think our leaders have recognized that. And nowadays, with your laptops and your cell phones and your streaming on the TV and how much we rely on electricity, when the power goes out, people screech. You know, they're calling Rocky Mountain Power and they're giving Rocky Mountain Power a hard time. We've become such a dependent society on our connectivity that may help propel and change some minds when it comes to the deployment of carbon-free energy when it comes to nuclear.
That's Amy Joy O'Donohue. She's a reporter with the Utah In-Depth team at the Deseret News. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Utah's push to get into the nuclear energy game. Governor Cox is calling for the state to double its power production over the next 10 years, and he wants a test reactor up and running in a year. The governor and lawmakers are banking on a new generation of technology. We spoke with the journalist Umer Irfan recently about this new type of reactor. Irfan is a correspondent for Vox.com, and he explained to us how these new, smaller reactors are different from the ones most of us have in mind when we think of nuclear energy.
We're talking about maybe something that's about a couple stories tall and a few feet wide, and they're producing about roughly in the tens to upwards of a couple hundred megawatts of power rather than producing hundreds of megawatts or up to a gigawatt. So almost an order of magnitude smaller in terms of their power output. But usually what they do in a lot of these reactor plant designs is you'll have several of these small modular reactors at a power plant. And so you'll have like a six pack essentially of these smaller things in a conventional design, and you can add and remove them as you see fit.
Are they less dangerous than the larger ones?
In theory, they are, because they're using newer designs that have passive safety measures in mind. So basically, if something were to go wrong, you could have almost no operator intervention for days at a time, and the reactor would essentially learn to shut itself off. The inherent mechanisms in there would basically let it cool down and prevent any further reactions from going on without any outside intervention. Many conventional nuclear power plants, for instance, they have to have a grid hookup. So not only are they sending power to the grid, they have to take power in from the grid in order to power all the backup systems. So things like cooling pumps and fans and all these other kinds of monitors. You may remember the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant disaster. Part of the reason that they had such problems was that their backup systems failed because they weren't able to get power into the plant in order to maintain all the cooling systems that they needed. And that's part of why we had that disaster. And so these new generation of plants, particularly the SMRs that are designed around this, wouldn't need that necessarily. They wouldn't have to be connected to the power grid and receive power in order to stay safe.
Governor Cox has said recently that the idea that he and lawmakers have in mind is going to create clean energy and cheap energy for the people of the United States. The idea of cheap, let's talk about that, and cost. One of the things you've written is that operating costs have actually increased over time for these. So what are the costs? Can this be done? Do we even know enough to say that this could be done cheaply?
There's a big difference between what can happen in theory and what can happen in practice.
Right.
In theory, you could potentially make a lot of changes that would make nuclear more feasible. But yes, you're right to point out that nuclear has the odd distinction of being the one energy source that continues to get more expensive with time. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One is simply that the goalposts for the nuclear energy industry are always moving. And so nuclear has its own entirely separate regulatory apparatus. Mm-hmm. And basically, as the technology improves for safety, the regulators require nuclear power plants to continually upgrade and use the latest equipment. But what that means is that even plants that were built 10, 20, 30, 50 years ago have to be constantly making these upgrades, and they have to make those at current cost, which means that those costs then have to be built into the power plant, and then it makes the electricity from there go up in price. Similarly, the nuclear workforce has been degrading for a long period of time. We have fewer nuclear engineers now than we did 20 years ago because we haven't been building very many nuclear power plants and there aren't very many jobs for them. And so the few nuclear engineers that are left are very scarce and they're very expensive to hire. And then on top of all that, the materials costs are always going up. We've had this bout of inflation over the past few years, and plus the trade war means that, buying things like steel, aluminum, and some of the high-tech parts that go into nuclear plants that are traded around the world, those are getting more expensive as well. well. And then to top it off, you know, nuclear doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's competing with other energy sources. And when you're competing against things like fossil fuels, things like natural gas, which is very cheap in the U.S., and then wind and solar, where the fuel is essentially free, even a cheap nuclear power plant can't really compete against almost free when it comes to electricity. And we've seen in the U.S., many nuclear power plants shut down ahead of schedule because they just couldn't play ball. Their power was being sold at too high of a price to be able to be competitive.
So do you think the Trump administration is trying to change that dynamic? I mean, he has, you know, issued these executive orders directing the Department of Energy and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to sort of streamline the testing process, to reform what they describe as the culture of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Like, do you sense that the Trump administration knows of those obstacles and are trying to fix it with those executive orders?
I think they have a sense of it. Yeah, you know, Energy Secretary Chris Wright has talked about this as well. And these are long, well-known issues with nuclear, you know, the regulatory hurdles and also the fact that the industry is just operating on a different level when it comes to things like financing. And the big thing for nuclear is this, that you need to have a lot of very patient money. We're talking about spending billions of dollars today and then getting that payback potentially decades down the line. If you have $10 billion and you're an investor on the private market, nuclear does not look like a great bet compared to solar, which could, you know, build a plant in a year and have it start generating returns right away. And so you need to have an investor like the federal government or serving as a backstop with loan guarantees to tell private financiers that they will have this little bit of an extra boost, this backing here, in order to make these kinds of investments that will take generations to pay back. It requires a lot of foresight. It requires a lot of far ahead thinking. And our political system is just not good at those things. And that's also part of the reason why nuclear has struggled for such a long time.
The founder of the company that's going to develop this test nuclear reactor in Utah, Valar or Valor Economics, a guy named Isaiah Taylor, he said that American entrepreneurs have to be able to go out and test these new nuclear designs like they were doing in the 60s and 70s and build plants all over the United States. And one of the arguments he makes is that, look, if you're ever going to work out the kinks, make it safe, you have to build a lot of these. And when you build a lot of these, you're going to be better at innovating. And so they're going to be safer and better over time. What do you make of that?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. You learn by doing. You know, like, again, we've been talking about how, like, all these traits of nuclear that are positive, those are all in theory. But then when we put them into practice, we find that there's a lot of obstacles. And so the things like cost and safety and reliability, when you test those in the real world, they don't necessarily pencil out for a lot of reasons, for things that you don't necessarily anticipate when you're only working in a laboratory or you're only working on a test bed. There's no better pressure test than actually putting a nuclear power plant on the power grid and actually making it compete on an open market and seeing what it can actually do. And then from there, you can learn and adapt and then revise. The problem with that, though, of course, is that one, the upfront investment for nuclear is very high. So just to experiment costs a lot of money. The timelines are very long. We're talking years and years just to get these plants up and running. And so it's not really technology that lends itself to a lot of rapid iteration and innovation the way solar and wind can do. So you still need a lot of patience. You still need a lot of money up front. But yeah, you do learn by doing, and you can also unlearn by not doing. And so because the U.S. has gone such a long time without building reactors on a big scale, a lot of the talent has been lost. A lot of the knowledge has been lost. And the companies that are trying to do that now are essentially starting from scratch or trying to pick up back where they left off in the 1980s, which was the last time we saw a lot of nuclear power plants under construction.
One of the things you've mentioned is that some people in the nuclear industry say that the problems aren't financial as much as they are political. And I'm wondering, where do you think we are these days? Is nuclear power on the rise or is it in decline? I mean, Germany, a couple of years ago, just 2023, they shut down all of their reactors. So I'm wondering what you make of the sort of political will and even the cultural sensitivities about nuclear energy. Where are we as far as you can tell right now?
You know, Germany's a very interesting case study. You know, back in the early 2010s, Angela Merkel, who was the chancellor at that time, was actually about to embark on a plan to build more nuclear in Germany. Yeah. And then the Fukushima Daiichi disaster happened, and she did a complete 180 and said that Germany's going to get rid of all of their nuclear power plants. And now the current government in Germany, looking at rising energy costs and looking at mounting demand for more electricity, is considering restarting some of these plants. And so it goes back and forth depending on market forces. It does go back and forth depending on culture. Here in the United States, there does seem to be more widespread support for nuclear than there has been in years past. There have been some polling that does show that there is more bipartisan support for nuclear energy than there has been before. And so this is something that we public, in terms of public interest, there seems to be fewer objections and more support. The question, though, is, again, how much investment and how much follow through there is going to be, both on the private sector and the public sector. Are we willing to invest government resources in seeing nuclear through? Like, are we willing to have the government become a purchaser for nuclear energy and setting rates and basically helping this industry get off the ground in a more direct way versus leaving it to the open market? And then there's also the other big political question that we haven't talked about, which is nuclear waste. Yeah. Right now, the United States does not have a permanent place to store nuclear waste. Almost all nuclear waste from civilian nuclear power plants is stored at the plant right now. But it's just been an extraordinarily thorny issue, just finding a place to put the waste. Only one country in the world right now has a permanent nuclear waste repository, and this is something that every country has to deal with.
Final question. When you look at the obstacles of cost, potential obstacles for cost, the question of waste, you mentioned political will. How are you thinking about I won't ask you to speculate, but the governor says we're going to have a lot of these operational nuclear reactors in Utah in time for the Olympics. That's a ways out. But does that seem like we're headed there, or we still have a lot of stuff to work out before we can make a statement like that?
I would definitely like to see the white papers on that before I weigh in on it. But yeah, you do have to do a lot of foundational work in order to make a project or a commitment like that pencil out. Again, for all the reasons that we mentioned, the financing is volatile and it's getting more expensive. The competition is very high, that nuclear energy, again, continues to get more expensive while just about every other energy source gets cheaper. And the main impetus, I think, for building new nuclear power plants, the biggest value add is that they do this without emitting carbon dioxide that contributes to climate change. Right. But politically, we're across at the federal level, at least in the U.S., we're basically dismantling all the infrastructure we have for dealing with climate change, including things like regulations on carbon and any potential for taxing carbon, which would be creating market incentives for nuclear. So we're kind of on one hand talking about how we need a lot of reliable baseload power within the state like Utah, but at the same time, some of the big climate concerns that would be the biggest arguments in favor of nuclear are things that are being undermined. And so how you can square that circle just on the finances, just on the operating costs and making the business case for that, I think is going to be extremely challenging. I think it will be a useful experiment one way or another to see if they can pull this off.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Umer Irfan, he covers climate change and energy policy for the news website Vox.com. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about Utah's ambitious vision for energy in the state. Leaders want to compete for data centers and AI facilities that use massive amounts of energy, and they want Utah to become a hub for a new generation of nuclear reactors. We've talked about the complications for the plan, the cost, the waste in particular, but there's also a more abstract question or issue here. It's Utah's troubled history with nuclear power. Thousands of people here lived downwind from the government's atmospheric bomb tests in the Nevada desert. They breathed in the fallout. They drank the contaminated water and food. And for decades, they watched as friends and family died from cancers they believed were caused by that exposure. We know them as downwinders, and their stories still shape how many Utahns feel about the nuclear age. We spoke with the historian Sarah Fox about this part of the story. She wrote a book called Downwind, A People's History of the Nuclear West. I want to begin with just your broad thoughts of how you're thinking about what a nuclear energy boom in Utah could mean in a broader sense, beyond the particulars of, you know, expense and waste and safety, which we'll get to, but just the idea of it happening in a place like this that has such baggage related to the testing of nuclear weaponry is now considering being part of it again. How are you thinking about it, just broadly speaking?
It's really painful, honestly, because I've spent over 20 years building relationships with people in Utah and the surrounding region who found that their homes had been used as sort of a laboratory with this new and very dangerous technology that people in positions of power knew was extremely dangerous. And they knew it would enter the food chain. It would cause harm to children. It would cause harm to people's bodies as they grew and aged. And so they made a deliberate decision to disproportionately target certain geographies with that risk. And Utah is one of those geographies. And so for me, you know, as a scholar, but also as a Westerner, it's painful to see Utah presented with this technology once again as a theoretical golden ticket. You know, this is going to bring all this income and all of this wonderful new technology and investment, but it's also going to bring all of this risk. And this new technology is experimental, just like nuclear weapons technology was when it was being tested in Nevada and the pollution was being dispersed over Utah and the surrounding region. So it's, for me, it's painful.
Can you tease out the promise of nuclear energy for the future from the history of nuclear weapons testing? Can you tease those two apart?
Even before we had nuclear weapons, we had science writers publishing articles and writing short stories about this kind of mythical future that would be made possible by harnessing the power of the atom. You know, cars that flew through the air and electricity too cheap to meter. This is an old mythology. When nuclear weapons are developed, nuclear power, the generation of nuclear power, that technology emerges explicitly in service of weapons production. And so when you start to see the development of commercial nuclear power, they are explicitly being proposed as a way to calm a public that's getting really, really uncomfortable with the ramifications of nuclear weapons technology, both in terms of what is becoming known by the early 50s about what radiation exposure did to people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and how horrific that was and indiscriminate, and also what radiation exposure is doing to people downwind of nuclear sites like the Nevada test site. Those stories are actively circulating in southern Utah, particularly by the mid-1950s. And ultimately, nuclear power plants, however much the industry and a lot of supporters of nuclear power try to separate them, nuclear power cannot materially or philosophically be separated from nuclear weapons production.
Let's get to the question that is front and center right now. And that is the urgency of the climate crisis.
Yes.
And the fact that nuclear power can generate large amounts of electricity without releasing carbon during, at least during operation. Like, how do you talk about that really essential argument? How do you weigh the real fear that a lot of people feel, the existential reality of a climate crisis, against the risks, of course, of nuclear energy, but the potential here? So how are you thinking about all of that?
I get asked about this a lot. Nuclear power is ostensibly, it looks like a clean alternative, but that leaves out the incredible dirtiness of nuclear at every single stage of the cycle, including power production, when we might look and see no visible signs of radiation entering the environment. So nuclear power, in order to generate it and have it flow from a plant into our power grid, you have to have fuel. So you have to extract fuel. And even modern nuclear reactors, like the SMRs that are often proposed in projects in Utah, they're fueled by uranium. And in order to get uranium out of the ground, you're creating incredible dangers for the workers who are extracting it, horrific workplace exposures to things like radon gas and silica dust, exposure for their families, the contamination of the water table where that uranium is being extracted. You then transport it, often in uncovered trucks, through rural communities where material is flying off those trucks and into people's vegetable beds and the places where they live and work and play. And then you have to mill it, which involves mixing that crushed uranium ore with all sorts of chemicals and solvents and pulverizing it into a really fine dust so that you can extract the yellow cake that you can use to generate nuclear power or build nuclear weapons. The waste material that's left over, it retains something like 90% of the radioactivity of the uranium that's been extracted to it. And that's just left in piles next to these uranium mills a lot of the time. And it just blows on the wind all around the West. Even if the uranium that was taken from those sites and made into fuel for a nuclear power plant, even if that nuclear power plant operated without any errors, any equipment malfunctions, even if that was the case, the original mining of that uranium, it's continuing to pollute the environment. And that part is never discussed when we're talking about clean, green nuclear power, is the incredible permanent contamination of the fuel stage of that cycle. Then you have the operation of a nuclear power plant. Plant operation is usually framed as statistically safe because we've had very few large-scale accidents like Chernobyl and Fukushima and Three Mile Island. But again, small-scale accidents and malfunctions happen constantly. And many of these small-scale accidents, you know, they're releasing radiation over a long period of time and no one's really paying attention. So it's entering into the local water supply. Ducks are landing on ponds that have been contaminated by it. They're drinking that water. They're eating fish from that water. They're taking it to other places. So plant operation is also actually very risky.
There is this cycle that you have been really interested in. In fact, you're writing about it. The cycle that you have noticed that happens in the pursuit of nuclear energy.
Yes.
Because everyone is talking about, okay, look, and I'm sure you get this as a response, we're in an era of innovation, Sarah. This is technology. We have artificial intelligence. We have the capacity to be able to work around, navigate through those historical challenges with developing nuclear energy in the past. But what you seem to be noticing in this cycle is that we're not breaking through with innovation. There's something going on there. Will you take us through how you understand this cycle?
Yeah. I think of this cycle as this sort of cycle of wasting, where we're presented with this new technology that has all of this promise, and we're persuaded to adopt it because it's been innovated by the very best and brightest that we have. And it's seen as something that, yes, is risky, but that we've arrived at this point of scientific and technological innovation where we can manage those risks. And so public fears are calmed, people are reassured, we get underway with this new technology, and then, oops, we have a Three Mile Island accident in 1979, and we have great public alarm in the United States about whether or not nuclear power can actually be produced safely. And what ends up happening is the nuclear power industry and the federal regulators responsible for overseeing that industry, they use that accident as an opportunity to reassert their expertise, to say, yes, mistakes were made in the past, but we now have even newer technology and even newer expertise, and we're on it. The experts have got it. We've got this new technological fix. We're going to put it on board, and we're going to kind of dismiss at a certain point the fears and the concerns of members of the public, members of the scientific community, as paranoid. And we hear this rhetoric a lot with this kind of latest wave of boosters of nuclear power as this clean alternative, the fossil fuel.
But why isn't it true? Why isn't that true?
Because nuclear technology is never actually under our control. when you're talking about a technology that relies on the chain reaction phenomenon, the notion that we can control that perpetually is a myth.
Yeah.
It's a fantasy. It doesn't matter how sophisticated our AI is or how many people we have, you know, sitting in front of a control panel monitoring the various parts of a nuclear power plant. It's human technology, which means that it's vulnerable to getting old, pipes decay over time, sensors wear out, and human beings, no matter how sophisticated their training is, are vulnerable to overlooking certain things, particularly if there's a production goal or a profit margin to be maintained. And this is why I am skeptical of this "we have a modern fix" rhetoric, because I've seen it deployed in every single decade in the historical record of every single decade since we started experimenting with nuclear technology. And every time that promise is made, a generation later, it's been revealed that we didn't actually have all the answers that time. And that that amazing new techno fix actually only addressed one part of the problem, and it made it worse in another area. We have not made the nuclear power industry safer over time. In fact, it's actively becoming more dangerous. And so this notion that, you know, the best and the brightest are going to come up with a fix that's going to resolve the problems of the past based on the lessons of the past is a fallacy.
So are you saying there needs to be a new way of thinking about this rather than thinking about it in these maybe older ways or conventional ways? Because one of the things you said is you don't rule out the possibility that this can be done right. But it sounds like what you're saying is we don't understand the conditions for doing it right. Is that what you're getting at?
Theoretically, I don't think currently the possibility of doing it right, doing it safely, exists. I haven't seen any evidence of that technology existing at this time. But I think that we are really trapped. The United States is a progress-oriented, future-oriented society. And that mythology, I think, really blinds us to the risks that are present in various forms of technology and energy production. And so I do think if we were, as a society, to attempt to move forward with a technology like nuclear power, doing so would necessitate a robust conversation about the full spectrum of risks associated with that technology.
Quick final question. When can we move on from the problematic history with nuclear weapons testing, the effect that it had on so many people in this state? When you're evaluating the possibilities for the future of developing nuclear energy, can you ever move past that problematic history, or should you?
It's a question that I grapple with a lot. And the answer that I keep coming back to is, where is the line when we can definitively say that we have gone far enough that children being born today in southern Utah, for example, if they're being born with health problems that are potentially related to the radiation exposure of their ancestors, you know, at what point have we gone far enough to rule that out? And the fact of the matter is, we know that radiation exposure in the parent generation can cause, you know, health problems in children that are born many decades after that exposure, that we pass on the implications of exposure to this technology to our descendants over and over and over again. And so I think the question of when can we move on is tangled up with how many generations are actually going to bear the cost of mistakes made in the past. And we don't have any, science doesn't have an answer for that yet. You know, we're still seeing these birth defects and these inherited cancers turning up in children who are being born in southern Utah today, you know, several generations after the end of atmospheric nuclear testing. And the other part of that answer for me is maybe when we solve the problem of nuclear waste. The idea of moving on from a vexed history, we can't really entertain that conversation if that history is still actively happening. Nuclear reactions that were set in motion by the Manhattan Project are still taking place. You know, plutonium unleashed on the environment in the pursuit of nuclear weapons technology in the 50s and 60s and 70s is still dangerous. It's still making people sick, you know, across the West. So the question of when do we move on It's a hard question to answer because it requires assuming that the past is actually past. But when we're talking about experimentation with nuclear technology, the past is very much with us.
Sarah Fox, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Sarah Fox, she's a professor of sustainability and education at Prescott College in Arizona. She's author of the book Downwind, A People's History of the Nuclear West. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER 90.1, on Instagram at Radio West. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.